welcome to episode 134 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And when you hear this, it should be Happy New Year. So we should say Happy 2025 to all of our listeners.
Yes, Happy New Year, everyone.
Gosh, I hope you've all had a lovely holiday season. And today we are doing a slightly different format because it's our end of the year. I want to call it a tradition because we've done it before.
I think it's our third one now, so yeah, it's definitely a tradition.
Where we are going to give you a rundown of both of our top 10 books of the year, and then at the end of the episode we will each choose one book from each other's top 10 to do as our books for the next edition of Tea or Books. So you'll be able to join in as well and read our favourites if you choose to. So first of all, Simon, how are you? How was your Christmas and what are you reading?
Thank you. Yeah, I had a lovely Christmas at my brother's with my parents were there as well. We alternate between their houses, and if I ever have spare bedrooms, then I will be on that list as well. But trying to get everyone into my little flat would not end well. But yeah, it was lovely. I was there for a week. It was very restful. My mum was sort of recovering from a chest infection, so we didn't do anything particularly unnecessarily exciting, except we did do an escape room together on Boxing Day. So that was fun. Yeah, we've got quite into them now. I wasn't sure if they'd work well as a family dynamic. I've done quite a few, but I was like, will we just be chaos as a family? But we actually worked together really well. So who knew?
So
that's fun.
And how quickly did you get out of the escape room?
Out in 51 minutes. But he did say that he'd only had six people that day. I guess most people are not going to an escape room on Boxing Day. And we were the only team to escape from the room. So
there we are.
That's very good. One bit did involve Colin being like locked in, not quite a box, it was a bit bigger than that, but you had to lock one of your team in there, and they were looking at ropes on top of this container, and it's like, well, I'm glad you were here, because I'd just have been like, let's just go. we're just going to press the alarm button and get out at this point. Yeah, it was fun. And I'm currently reading a book I'm really, really enjoying called Letters to Gwen John by Celia Paul. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't, but I've just read a book about her. So
My friend Claire gave it to me for my birthday, and it's a really beautifully produced book. It's a hardback, really thick paper, and lovely paintings in it. I didn't know much or read anything about Gwen John and Celia Paul, but they're both artists. Celia Paul has written this, and she's written it partly as prose and then partly as letters to Gwen John, and Celia Paul is painting now, living now, and Gwen John was many decades ago, but it's sort of this faux sisterhood across this gap of time and space. They're both, I guess, better known for being related to male artists or in relationships with male artists. So Gwen John is related to Augustus John, and she had a relationship with Rodin. And Celia Paul had a relationship with Lucian Freud. Both of those relationships had a 35 or 37 year age difference. So, Lucian Freud was 55 when he started dating the 18 year old Celia Paul. So, discuss. But it's it's a really beautiful, interesting, occasionally imagining, lovely book about art, I guess, and about the life of an artist, about what it demands from you and that sort of thing. So it's very immersive and really enjoying it.
Oh, wow.
How about you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I've literally just become an auntie for the fourth time. So that's been exciting. Literally been sent the photo while we're doing the podcast. So congratulations to my brother, my friend. So what have I been up to? Family Christmas. As always, a joy, lots of fun. Got dragged out of bed very early in the morning to do presents. My nephew, who I felt was too old for Christmas, but apparently 13-year-olds still get really excited about Christmas. So there we are. So that was nice. It's been very nice and restful. I get 3 weeks off work at Christmas, and I have needed those 3 weeks. So I had a lovely first week off, which was the week before Christmas, just reading and lazing around, which is lovely. So what's interesting doing this episode and looking back at how much you've read over the year, and I have these bursts of reading loads during holiday. Yeah. Absolutely nothing in the meantime. All the only books I've read are books I'm teaching. So I've read an absolute ton over the last couple of weeks, which has been nice. And then I'm off to Spain tomorrow for a few days, which to get some sunshine, because it's just been relentlessly grey in England.
So grey.
So I just need to get some warmth and some sun on my face. So I'll be doing that. And I've got my books ready for the plane. So excited to get started. I'm going to be reading The Years by Annie Ernaux. I'm going to see the play that is on in London. It was on in the summer and I couldn't go because I was in New York, which makes me sound ridiculously glamorous, but I'm and it's now gone to the West End, so I'm really excited to go and see the play, and I want to read the book before I watch it. It's been like the number one play of the year in every so as people know, I'm a big theatre buff, so I'm excited to go and watch that. I'm interested to see what the book is like. So that's what I've got coming up. But at the moment, I'm reading something that feels really intellectual. And it's a biography of the wife of Bath. By Marion Turner. So it's a really interesting book all about the character and also medieval women in general, looking at who would... how does the wife of Bath fit into what women, you know, expected roles for women, what women's lives would have been like in medieval Britain, and also about the way in which writers have and other artists have taken the wife of Bath's character and repurposed her over the centuries since Chaucer wrote the Canterbury Tales. So not something that a period of literature that I ordinarily have much interest in. And I just thought one of my students is going to be studying it for a part of the course that we do. So I thought I better brush up on this. And there just so happens to be an exhibition on medieval women on at the British Library at the moment, which is all about medieval women in their own words. So reclaiming manuscripts from the archives that do detail women's lives and also written by women. And a lot of these pieces of, you know, like books and manuscripts and letters and so on haven't been displayed before. So that was really, I went yesterday because I live around the corner from the British Library, and I was surprised it was packed, which I was delighted to see. And really, really interesting. And I've been reading about all of these women writers in the book, and then getting to go to the library and then actually see the manuscripts of these things that I've just read about.
Oh, that's cool. Amazing.
So yeah, I really enjoyed that. So I think it's on until March. So if anybody's interested, I do recommend it. It's really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So there we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I thought actually perhaps before we talk about our top 10 songs, it might be interesting to talk a bit about the year in review in terms of how we feel about what we've read in general. Has it been a typical reading year for you? Have you taken on any challenges or gone down any different routes than you might have done ordinarily? Any like resolutions that you stuck to or didn't stick to?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's fun. So I've mentioned probably before on the podcast that I've been doing my thing, A Century of Books, this year. It's the third or fourth time I've done it. So it's reading a book published across 100 years. This time was 1925 to 2024, not in order. Yeah. And it's been really fun. It's, in fact, one of the books that we'll get to on my list, I would never have read if I hadn't had a year that I was really struggling to fail. And so I went and, in fact, got an audiobook for that year and absolutely loved it. So I finished the challenge on the 27th with Alice Thomas Ellis's book and In at the Edge of the World, which I didn't realize when I picked up, but happily tend to be set at Christmas. It was about people invited to go to this inn on a Scottish or remote Scottish island to escape sort of the commercialism and the bustle of Christmas. And it was very, very good. It's my third book by Alice Thomas Ellis and definitely my favorite. More broadly, I think when I was making this list, there were a few definite standouts and then lots and lots that I thought were really, really good books. I don't think there's any books Well, no, that's not true. There's not many that I'd be like, these are all-time absolute favourites. I think maybe the top three on this list I might put in that category, which, you know, is a good, I guess, a good number. And then, but there was, after that, there were so many I could have put in my top 10. So definitely some really, really good reads, but not sort of, I don't know, not you know, when you first discovered Virginia Woolf or something, it's like, oh my gosh, my life changed. But maybe that doesn't happen anymore when you're in your late 30s. Having said that, from my top 10, only two of them are authors that I'd read before. So it's been nice to discover lots of new names this year.
Yeah.
How about you?
I've read a lot less this year than I do ordinarily. And I don't know, well, I do know why that is. It's because I started teaching again and I was in a new job for a lot of the year. So I've had a lot of, not had as much time to read, and had the lot of the reading I've had to do has for work. So, I mean, a lot of the books in my list are books that I've taught rather than books that I've chosen to read, which has been interesting. And I've had really concentrated periods where I've read like six or seven books back to back where I've been on holiday for a while and then nothing for ages, which also means when I'm looking at the list now, I've actually, a lot of them I must have read so quickly I can't necessarily really remember all the details of about, or I know whether I liked them or not. Also, interestingly, many of these books have been read while on modes of transport. So many of these books have been read on planes or journeys. So, yeah, interesting. I think that for me, what I found most interesting looking at my list was that I actually quite struggled to choose 10. That I had really, like, really enjoyed. I wouldn't say it was a bumper reading year for me in terms of reading stuff that I really enjoyed and was really engaged with. I think my main kind of thread through this year was I read all of George Orwell, which was prompted by me reading Wifedom by Anna Funder, which is a biography of George Orwell's wife. But also in general, looking at the role of the wife in culture. And I read that while on holiday in Malta. And then
she gets about.
Yeah.
I went to Wales four times this year for, you know, by comparison.
But it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place.
It's a lovely place.
And that I've also read a fair amount of nonfiction as well, which I was quite pleased by, because it's normally something that I avoid because it takes me longer to read. But I have made a concerted effort to read a bit more nonfiction this year. So yeah, but no, it's been a bit of a quiet reading year, I would say, though I have indeed discovered a new favourite author, who I won't mention yet because it's gonna come up in my top 10. So
okay.
Yeah.
Well, shall we get started with our 10 then? Do you want to kick us off with your number 10?
I will. So my number 10 is a very slim novella called Maud Martha by Geraldine Brooks, which I read in the summer holidays. And I don't remember an enormous amount about the plot, but I think it's because there wasn't really much of one. And Geraldine Brooks was an American writer. She's just recently been republished and writing a really beautiful, lyrical, poetical, that the experience of being a black woman in America in the sort of early 20th century. And I just found it so beautiful and so profound, the explorations of what it is to, like, be in love and to long for something more than what you have. Also the kind of the beauty and joy that you can find in the mundanity of everyday life. And it was a sort of one of those books where nothing happens, but you're just immersed in the world of this character, and the way in which Geraldine Brooks just has these beautiful turns of phrase, the way that she's able to kind of put in a sentence such a big feeling or a big emotion, and also the little things that she notices. It's like this lovely passage at the beginning where she's looking out of the window and she just sees the flowers outside, and it's springtime, and it's just her, she's doing the washing up or something, and she just sees these daffodils outside, and it's just like she has this moment of, like, this epiphany of how wonderful the world is in that moment. And it's just yeah, really just lots of special moments like that throughout the book. And it's not a book I would ever have picked up. I hadn't heard of the author. I just happened to be in Waterstones and they had a display of Black women's writing. And I was like, oh, let's have a look at some of these. I've not heard of some of these writers. And it was a really pretty edition as well, which also made me want to pick it up. And I just thought, gosh, this sounds wonderful. And I read the first page and I was in. And so I thought I'll buy that. So I haven't read anything else of hers yet, and that's something I will intend to get to next year. And yeah, so it's also just one of those books where if you've got an hour and you're just sitting, it was a lovely summer book, like sitting in the sun and just reading it, and that's all it takes is an hour to read, and you're just utterly imaginatively transported into the head of this woman who's such a beautiful person. And I just really enjoyed it.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. Yes, I wonder why it's taken so long to be rediscovered, but yeah, that's always the way, isn't it? Lovely. My number 10 is My Darling Villain by Lynn Reed Banks. We've talked about Lynn Reed Banks before. You know that I really, really love her novel, The L-Shaped Room, and you don't like it at all. But this is one of her young adult novels before that term existed, published, I think, in the 70s, maybe the early 80s. And it's about a 15-year-old called Kate. It starts when she's planning a sort of get together of friends at her house, but it gets out of hand when word gets around that the party is happening and various ne'er-do-wells gate crash, and it becomes nothing particularly out of hand, but you know, a bit of, you know, food thrown around and furniture broken and that sort of thing. All of the sort of the bad boys, Scarpa, except a boy called Mark who stays behind to clean up, and she is intrigued by Mark. And the novel is basically about that perennial British topic of class. He is working class, she is middle class, and it's about the sort of faltering romance between them. And I was just completely captivated by it. Whenever I'm making my lists, it's sort of a mix of how good I think the book is and then how much I enjoyed it, which isn't always the same thing. And I don't know if this would necessarily, you know, win literary awards, but she's such a good storyteller. She's so good at character. And yeah, I just fell in love with that central pair. There's a lot of interesting subplots in it. I imagine anyone reading this at the age of 15 would fall for it even harder, but I fell for it pretty hard in my late 30s.
I mean, you love a little bit of Lynn Reed Banks, don't you?
Love her. I mean, she can be, not to put your finer point on it, racist. So, you know, relieved that this one had no racism in it. And, none that I remember. So, yeah, I think she's just a wonderful storyteller. And I read two or three of hers this year, and this was my favourite of those.
And where are you at in terms of reading all of her stuff?
Yeah, I think I've got a few adult novels and most of the young adult novels.
Oh, okay.
Left.
She
was quite prolific. And then for a long time, I just reread the L-Shaped Room trilogy over and over again. So I hadn't actually explored that much beyond those, but I just read those a lot. Mm. And this was the year I thought I should actually read some of her other things, and to a mixed success. But this was the fun one.
Well, maybe I need to give her another go. I mean,
I think you'd like this one.
I love the Indian in the Cupboard books as a child.
Well, yes, me too. That was my first. And The Farthest Away Mountain, another children's book of hers. That's where I first fell for her.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, I just love those Indians in the Cupboard. That was just like the best thing ever. Those toys that came, those little figures that came to life. And there was also a TV series.
Yes, The Native American in the Cupboard, as it may be retitled now, who knows? But yeah.
Yes. There's the scope for me there to discover. I'll bear that in mind. Add that to my list. So on to number nine. My number nine is another book I read on holiday. This time,
where were you this time?
This time I was in Penzance. So
okay. A little
less glamorous in the UK. Had a very long train journey, which was helpful for this one. And it's called Enter Ghost by Isabella Hamad. And it's a book that I was intrigued by for two reasons for why I picked it up. Firstly, because it's set in Israel and Palestine, and I wanted to, it's a it's an area of the world that I don't know a huge amount about, and I wanted to read more about it from the perspective of somebody who's from that region. And also it's about an actress who's in a production of a Shakespeare production of Hamlet in Gaza. So was also interested from the theatrical. So it's a really interesting book. It's a little bit overlong, I would say. And it's not a book that I would say, you know, it's not a quick read. It's one you kind of have to just sort of go along with. I wouldn't say it's the best book, best written book I've ever read. But in terms of the character of, whose name I can't remember, I'm going to Google it because I need to know what she's called.
I'm sure I'm going to forget quite a few character names in this episode.
Sonia, that's it. So Sonia is the main character, and she's grown up in Britain to a family who are from Israel. Yes, they live in Israel, but they're Arab Israelis. So they've also got Palestinian citizenship. And she has always kind of, you know, not really been that interested in her sort of family life over there or wanting to connect to the family over there. And then she has this kind of terrible, she's in her mid-30s, she has this terrible love affair that goes wrong, and she's got no work lined up. And she's like, oh, do you know what? I'm going to go and stay with my sister. Her sister, however, lives in Israel. So she goes to stay with her for the summer. And while she's there, she manages to get embroiled in being in this production of Hamlet that she doesn't really want to be in, but then she's got nothing else to do, and she does it as a favor to her sister's friend, and she ends up in this situation. And it's kind of like, it's the story of this production, it's the story of the conflict between the two countries, it's the story of what happens when families involved in the conflict get torn apart. But it's also about a woman in her 30s coming to terms with choices that she's made and figuring her life out. And so there's lots going on, and I think the setting makes it really interesting. And for me, I just felt terribly ignorant reading it because there's so much history there that I just didn't know and didn't understand fully. So I had to do quite a lot of research while I was reading to make sure I understood all of the different connotations and references and nuances. But I really enjoyed it from that perspective. I really wanted to challenge myself more to read books set in countries and cultures that I don't know much about, because I want to learn more, and I don't want to just shy away from reading about stuff I don't already have a good knowledge of, because that's not very open-minded of me. So, I really enjoyed it. And I thought it was a really interesting way of exploring conflict in the region by kind of having this concept of putting on this play in a space where you wouldn't think about people accessing Shakespeare, and how important it is for people to have access to culture and what culture does for communities. But also thinking about something I think would have been more interesting is if it had explored maybe why Hamlet, and there were parts of it that kind of thought a bit about it, but I would have liked a bit more integration of why Shakespeare and why now and why in this place. But it was a really interesting read. Like I say, slightly overlong. It did feel a bit like, come on, let's just get to the point now. But I did really enjoy it, and I would recommend
it. Great, yeah. It's been on a lot of, was it last year it came out? I remember it was on a lot of lists last year, I think, or maybe I've just seen people talk about it this year. Yeah. But I've not read it, but it has been on my list of things that I've been wanting to read. I'm interested that you say you felt you had to go and look things up. Do you think it's not, does it assume knowledge from people already? Yes. Or could you learn through the book? No.
I mean, you can sort of pick up, like, you can get the gist of it, you can understand. But for me, there were references to historical events and things that are kind of thrown in as if you just assume you know what they are and what that's referring to. And I didn't. So I had to go and find those things out.
If I read it, I will make sure to have Wikipedia open at the same time.
Yeah.
My number 9 is The Department of Speculation by Jenny Offill.
I took that out of the library but didn't read it.
Ah, interesting. Well, I'd read a few books that I really loved in the last couple of years that were told through fragments and vignettes, but they were all nonfiction. I was intrigued to read it in fiction. And Department of Speculation is basically a portrait of a marriage or people meeting, marrying, having losing a pregnancy, having one of them has an affair, and it goes through all of this in hundreds and hundreds of these short, often completely unlinked, untethered fragments, some of which are just one or two words, some of which I think they get up to about a page at the longest. And the first one, it'll show you how seemingly arbitrary they can be. The first one is, antelopes have 10 times vision, you said. It was the beginning or close to it. That means that on a clear night, they can see the rings of Saturn. And that's the first one. Yeah. And I think what makes it work so well is it's like the sort of patchwork put together, but it can be, Offal just wasn't at all restricted by tone. So you could have something that was very, very deep, and then suddenly something that is just an objective fact, and then suddenly then you go into someone's heartbreak, or all these different things together, and it's like you're sort of circling the relationship at all time and building up an understanding of the characters and understanding of their dynamic together, and I think it's such an effective storytelling. She does it so well. I've not read anything else by her. I know Weather, I think, is probably her most famous one. I've not read that yet. But I was blown away by it. I think it's so short, and it's just so well done in the way that it feels very ambitious, but also very accessible. And just it's so rare to get a really fresh take on novel writing that doesn't feel very obfuscatory, like when people are like, I'm reinventing the novel form, that's often in a way that makes it unreadable, whereas this, she's trying something really different. And I know that the sort of fragmentary approach to novel writing is probably a bit in vogue, so there's probably lots of examples now, but it's the first one I've read in fiction, and I'm really keen to read more like it. Absolutely loved it.
Well, there we are. So I wish I'd read that book now and taken it back on time. As per our discussion in the last podcast.
Exactly. so you could take it out again if they've not banned you. We'll see.
I'm on the, there's a photo of me behind the desk.
Do not lend this woman books.
Terrible person. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Isn't it funny that, you were reading that, I was thinking about it, I'd come across it, but I hadn't actually.
Funny. And I can't remember who, someone recommended it to me and I can't remember who. But thank you to whoever that was.
Okay. All right. So my number 8 is much more of a classic that people will have heard of. 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia. So this was another book read by the pool in Malta. I should say Goza. It was on Goza. And it was wonderful. And for me, is a book I've been meaning and wanting and thinking I should read for a very long time, and I have avoided because I had this belief that I didn't like magical realism and I wasn't prepared to go there. And I got to the airport, and a worry that I'm sure has seized many of us book lovers came across me as I walked past W.H. Smith, thinking, do you know what? I just don't think I have enough books on for this trip. This could be a problem. I need to get another book. And I was in a rush because, as late as I am for everything in life, as Simon knows, I was. So I was like, I've got 5 minutes. I've got to choose something and I've got to go to the gate like now. So I thought, well, they had this big display of classics you've never read at the front. I was like, W.H. Smith, you're in my mind. And then one of the first ones on the kind of display thing was 100 Years of Solitude. And I thought, that'll do. I'll take that one. And I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I was really surprised by how much the magic realism didn't bother me. And once I was in the world and I kind of accepted the rules of that world, I was like, okay, this is normal for this world. And I just have to accept that and go with it. Once you've accepted that setup and you understand that this is going to happen and no one else is going to think this is weird, then you can just, it surprised me by how much I was able to just get into it. And it's such a wonderful book, so beautifully written, so interesting, and the characters so well created and so rich and multi-layered, and just unlike anything I've ever read before. And I absolutely loved it and would happily read it again. So there we are. Yeah.
Yes, I've not read that. The only one I've read by him is Memoirs of Our Melancholy Whores, Memoirs of My Melancholy Whores, something like that, which I remember enjoying, but it's quite creepy. It's a very old man having sex with a very young woman, in fact, girl. But yes, that seems to be his vibe. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, and I think you talked a bit about it in the last episode when we talked about our sort of reading rules.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you broke your reading rule. My number eight, I've also mentioned, is my only non-fiction in my top 10, and it's A Body Made of Glass by Caroline Crampton, which is subtitled A History of Hypochondria, which I listened to her reading the audiobook, which she did very well. And it's a genre that I love, which is where it's a mix of memoir and research. So it's partly about a history of hypochondria, but it's also about her own experiences with hypochondria or health anxiety. She explains why they're not exactly the same thing, but uses them more or less interchangeably. She also had cancer as a teenager, so she had some very legitimate health concerns. And it means that when she does experience health anxiety, she is seen more readily than others might be. But it's I found it really helpful book, really fascinating book, rallying cry at times, particularly for how women and people of color are treated in healthcare settings. And she's such a good writer. It's really engaging. It's I'd say it probably leans maybe slightly more towards memoir than history, although maybe that's just the bits that interested me the most. And the title comes from a vogue happened a few centuries back where that people believed that they were made of glass. And that was a form that health anxiety took at the time. And, you know, there'd be people who walked around with padding all over them because they thought they would fracture if someone, you know, knocked into them or something. And Charles or something of France was a notorious sufferer from that particular hypochondria. So yeah, she's known in the podcasting world as the host of the She Done It podcast. People might be familiar with that. And this is very different from that, but really fascinating. And I think quite important book, I think hopefully will make a difference to the way that people who experience hypochondria are treated, because it's so often, particularly in literature, it's so often treated as a foible. It's like, you know, Mr. Woodhouse and Emma. It's sort of just an annoyance to other people and something a bit silly, but she really brings across how debilitating and all-consuming it can be. Fascinating book.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'm intrigued by that one. Okay, so number seven. Now, this is not the first time we're going to see this author on my list.
Or indeed, not the last, I suppose you mean.
Yes, not the last. Sorry. And it's an author that I've come across very recently, actually, within the last couple of months, and I've already read all of their books. So, yes, they're very short, which is helpful. So this book is called Foster by Claire Keegan.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I've read it. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So Claire Keegan is an Irish writer, and she actually only writes short stories and novellas, well, so far. Which is perfect for somebody short on time like me. And Foster is, I think, her most recent one.
She does have one out like a couple of weeks ago. What was it called? So Late in the Day or something like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's more like a short story, though, to be honest.
Increasingly, they are getting shorter and shorter, aren't they?
I did buy that one, and I was like, it's a bit of a cheek that you've charged £10 for 50 pages. But Foster is, so I guess I would say it's her most recent sort of long form. And is about, set in Ireland, and it's about a girl who goes to stay for the summer with relatives. Her mum has got loads of kids, has just had another baby, she can't cope with her at the moment. And so it's this rural farming community, and she's kind of farmed out, if you like, to these two relatives. It's not entirely clear how exactly they're related to the family, but they know each other, and she goes to stay with them. And we get glimpses through, she's only very little, so we get glimpses through the narrative of that she's used to being spoken to quite harshly and not having opportunities to do things. And there are lots of sort of heartbreaking moments of where she's kind of treated with unexpected kindness and how she responds to that. And the couple that take her in are really lovely and caring towards her, and the relationship that they build over this sort of long summer holiday is really beautiful. And I won't say too much, but there's lots of really, it's such a short book, but something that packs in so much, and it's so poignant and moving and touching and powerful, and I cried loads at the end. And I think it's, and also at other points inside, it took me an hour to read and I was like a mess by the end. I just thought it was so beautiful. And Claire Keegan writes in this wonderful kind of unfussy, sparse prose, and I can't quite put my finger on what makes her so good, but she's just brilliant. And I absolutely loved this. And I would have put it higher, but there's something else higher up the list. So,
yeah, I've read a couple by her, possibly the other one that you'll mention, I won't say yet. But and I've enjoyed them, but I will confess I have not worked out quite what the fuss is about. And I know Jackie Wine, she really, really loves her. I think her books of the year for the past couple of years have been by her. And I'm like, I can't quite see it. I don't understand. But I like them a lot, but it's, yeah, I'm not getting the magical spark that a lot of people clearly are. She's on a lot of best of lists. She recently bought her short story collection, Antarctica. So I thought I'm intrigued to read her when she's actually doing out and out short stories rather than just sort of short fiction.
Okay.
By contrast, my number 7 is enormously long. It's The Visitors by Mary McMinnies, which Barb at Leaves and Pages recommended years ago, and I bought instantly after reading her blog review and read it 6 years later. So, and I was put off by the length because it's, I think my copy's about 575 pages of tiny font. So it's probably the length of about 3 regular sized novels. And it's about a man who's sent to be in the civil service or ambassador or something along those lines in a made-up country that is clearly intended to be Poland, yes, Warsaw, yes, I think he's in Warsaw. Well, it's never said where it is, but it's somewhere like that in the 70s. And there's quite a small cast. There's just him and his wife, who are the main characters, their 2 children, their nanny, and then they meet an impoverished countess, very impoverished, who befriends them and is very annoying. There's various other members of the, inverted commas, expat community, not a term I like using generally, but that's very much how they define themselves. Various American people there, various other people from Britain. And it's an unusual novel in that it's so, so just dense and slow, which sounds negative, but I found it really interesting storytelling that she just gives you every detail remorselessly, and it means you can't help but be sucked into that world completely. It's so immersive, and sometimes it's is a technique where, you know, there's an example where someone is crying, or a woman is crying, and she could just have written men don't like it when women cry or something, but she talks for basically a page and a half about types of crying and what it does to the man observing and all his reactions to it. And it's so granular and detailed. And the whole novel is like that. You basically, you can't speed read it. You can't even, I read it over the course of 6 weeks while I was reading various other things. And I very seldom have felt so absorbed in a world. And I think the reason it worked for me is because there aren't many characters. So it wasn't a case of a really long book where I'm losing track of who everyone is. I'm just learning more and more and more about these really interesting characters. And the plot is sort of incidental, but it's an incredible character study.
Did it need to be as long as it was, do you think?
I think it would just be a very different sort of book if it weren't. I think the sort of form is the contents of this one. I think if it had been half the length, it would just have felt like a sort of slightly ordinary story, I guess. But there's something about the way that, I don't know, it's like a really, really detailed painting or something where you're like, that's actually the point of it, is that there are all the details are there.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that it was worth the time commitment.
Yeah, I'm glad that I did not give up after 5.5 years of it on the shelf, but I just thought, no, its time will come.
Well, it just goes to show there's, when we get told off for stockpiling books, there is a time.
Exactly. And it's not in print, but it's pretty easy to find secondhand.
Okay, lovely. Well, all right. That could be an option. Sounds intriguing. But do I want to read 500 and something?
I know, I was going to say, we might have to skip January if we do, but we'll see.
Okay, so slightly darker choice for me for my number 6, which is another book read on a plane. I'm Denmark.
Oh my gosh.
Which I went to twice last year, this year.
Oh wow, I've never been.
It's because one of my best friends lives there. So
nice.
So this book is called Chernobyl Prayer by Svetlana Alexievich, and it's nonfiction. And I did talk about it on the podcast, so some people heard me discussing it. And it's a piece of journalism, and it's accounts Chernobyl, having lived through Chernobyl, from people who were living in the town, people who were exposed to radiation, and looking at their experiences over a period of time after the events, and how their lives have been affected. And it's really powerful, it's really moving. It's not in any way, shape or form an uplifting read, but it's an important one. And I think that kind of Svetlana Alexievich has written a lot of really interesting journalistic books about the experiences of people, the lived experiences of people in Russia and Eastern Europe. And I think a lot of people in Chernobyl, from what's in this book, feel very much that they were forgotten, and their voices weren't heard, and they're kind of, you know, everybody knows about Chernobyl, but they don't necessarily know how people's lives, I mean, this book I think was first published in the 90s maybe, their lives were still being affected, and how long a legacy it's had, and how much actually people were not supported, and were largely abandoned and lied to a lot of the time, and struggled to access support and compensation and so on. And so yeah, it's not something that's going to make you feel good about the world when you get to the end of it, but I think it's like testimony and importance to kind of understand and appreciate the horror of what happened, and also, and you know, thinking about, we can't let this happen again. I think it's an incredible book, and so sensitive. You can tell from the interviews that the people really trusted Svetlana Alexievich to tell their stories, and to they've been so open with her about how they feel and what happened to them, and describing the most painful moments of their lives. You know, a lot of women in this book, because a lot of the interviews are with women, because a lot of the men all of the men who worked in the power plant died, pretty much. Women describing what happened, like watching as their partners died, and some of these men took weeks to die, and what their radiation did to their bodies. Like, I had no idea. It's horrific. And
yeah, what led you to pick this up?
A friend at work recommended it to me and said, you should read this. And I was like, okay. And I wasn't expecting it to be what it was. So when I took it to read on the plane,
I was going to say, what a lovely holiday read.
Yeah, I hadn't anticipated that would be what I was going to get, but I found it utterly compelling nonetheless. So yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, on the plane, I found myself sitting next to one of my students, which was, just one of those life's coincidences, while reading this really depressing book that my colleague at work had recommended. So there we are.
Well, it's probably good you weren't reading 50 Shades of Grey or something in that situation. So.
Could have been worse.
My number 6 is the most modern novel on my list, Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid, that published in 2019. So it was on a lot of best of books of 2019 lists, but I I picked it up in the Audible sale and listened to it. Really brilliant narrator whose name I can't remember. I've mentioned it on the podcast before as well, I think, but it's about this black woman who's in her mid-20s who works as a babysitter for this wealthy white family. And there's a sort of incident where they have to get the toddler, or maybe older than toddler, out of the house quickly. So they phone her and say, would you mind coming and babysitting her straight away, but you can't be in the house with her. And the main, obviously I've forgotten everyone's names, but the main woman is at a party, so she comes along in her party dress and takes the little girl down to the local newsagent equivalent, and some sort of what we might call a Karen nowadays sees this young black woman with a young, with a little white girl, and the woman is clearly in party clothes, and so she calls the security guard who then calls the police, and it sort of starts off, this is an incident that starts the ball rolling for sort of a network of relationships. She stays babysitting for this family. She also meets this white man there who later becomes her boyfriend. There's a very clever twist halfway through that I won't spoil, what I found so interesting is it's about race in modern day America, but it doesn't have these sort of ogreish white baddies. The two main white characters are very, they would consider themselves very progressive and very vocal on that, but it's showing how damaging even people like that can be in these race relations. And yeah, it's just really, it's such a page turner whilst also being beautifully written. And yeah, I'd really recommend the audio book experience to people as well. So yeah, there's a reason that everyone was raving about it in 2019.
Okay, well, only 5 years late.
I know.
That does sound very interesting and probably something I would enjoy as well. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Ed.
Fun to consider. Right, so we're up to top five now.
Top five.
So for me, number five was Wifedom by Anna Funder. Mm. Started off my Orwell, I guess, obsession this year, where I was like, right, I need to find out more. I need to read more. And I read this by the Paul Ian Gozo also. And I absolutely loved it. And Anna Funder is known for Stasiland, which is a kind of, I guess, mixture of historical reportage, journalism. Also, I don't think there's any fictionalized elements, but her kind of voice comes into it as well. And so she's sort of done the same thing with Wifedom, where she looks at the life of Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who was the wife of George Orwell, the first wife of George Orwell, though his second marriage was very brief. And she died. That's why he got married again. And about basically how she had a really pivotal role in George Orwell's writing and was erased from his work, his history, his life, really, by Orwell himself, as well as Orwell's biographers after his death. And Anna Funder was prompted to write the book after realizing that this had happened. And one of the biggest kind of omissions she found was when she read Homage to Catalonia and Eileen sort of barely features. She's like making the tea or something, you know, in the hotel room. And it turns out that she was actually running the entire office of the political army, like organization that I can't remember exactly what it's called, that Orwell was supposedly part of. While he was, you know, sitting out on the street having a fag, she was upstairs basically coordinating, getting all of everybody in and out of the country, getting the passports. And the reason in Homage to Catalonia, he talks about how the risk he's taking every day, and that he could be shot when he leaves the apartment. The reason why that was happening was because of the work she was doing, and actually she was the person he was under threat of being killed and not him. So there's loads of examples. It's an infuriating book that makes you realize just how often women are written out of history, and how much their work is also not considered work. So it's now quite widely accepted that Eileen gave Orwell the idea for Animal Farm and did a lot of the work behind the writing of that book. And without her, the book would not exist. But that's not a widely known fact by readers, and something that was hidden for a long time, and that George Orwell himself never acknowledged. And so there's a lot of complexity in reading this book, because it makes you realise that George Orwell wasn't perhaps a particularly nice person. That obviously doesn't take away from the brilliance of his writing, but the problematic, but also how Eileen sort of accepted that role as well and was prepared to put up with it. So you've also got to kind of sit with that and think about, okay, well, what does drive a woman to accept those conditions, and a woman who's really intelligent and talented in her own right to feel that comfortable, I guess, subsuming her own identity between that of someone else's, so underneath that of someone else's. So yeah, it was a really powerful read, really interesting. I love how she looks at the life of Orwell's wife and then uses that as a sort of jumping off point, but not really, because she does talk sort of more broadly about the role of wives in history, and a lot of that stuff is, you know, I would say unnecessary, because I mean, those of us who have any interest in feminism know all of this stuff already. But she provides a kind of framework through which you can see this erasure of Orwell's wife and how that is part of a pattern of wider erasure and what it means to be a wife, and in ways that, like, what it doesn't mean to be a husband, if you see what I mean. So I absolutely loved it. I found it a very engrossing read, and for something that's like nonfiction, I think it's fair to say is often feels a bit more like a challenge to read than fiction. You know, you feel like you have to concentrate more. You're not going to sit and read 100 pages in one go necessarily in a way that you would with a really rollicking story. But I did find myself really able to read loads in a go, because it's so well written and so interesting. It's not like a load of dry facts or anything like that. So absolutely loved it and highly recommended.
Brilliant. Yeah. I remember you mentioning it on the podcast before and it sounded fascinating. In fact, I hadn't realized it was this year. I was thinking it was last year. Thank you. Yeah, it was an interesting title for it, because I do wonder if something more openly or obviously about Orwell and his wife might have giving you a different impression of the sort of book you're reading, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. So seem to be making big claims. But okay, we might need to speed up. We're going long, but maybe we'll enjoy that. My number five is a novel by an author that I know you've enjoyed, but I don't know if you've read this one. It's The Oracles by Margaret Kennedy. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
So I've read quite a few Margaret Kennedy, and they range from not finishing them to really liking them, but this is the first one I really loved. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It's set in a small village called East Head, and it's about, I guess, sort of warring factions there, but it centers around there's this well-known sculptor called Conrad Swan, who lives there with his mistress and a whole rag bag of children. And he's a noted sculptor. He's absent for most of the novel, but he's left the sculpture that he's working on behind it's called Apollo. The novel opens with this big thunderstorm. What the reader knows and what the intelligentsia of the village do not know is that the sculptor that they think is Apollo is actually a piece of garden furniture that's been struck by lightning. So that's sort of comic starting point of it. There's all these sort of local people who want to put the village on the map, want to put themselves on the map, want to be considered very, the creme de la creme, and so they're fawning over this wonderful sculpture. There's also the sort of main characters in it are this couple called Christina and Dickie and Christina, who have been married for not very long and both seem to be slightly regretting it. Christina's very anxious that people will think she's provincial. It's a word that Dickie uses of her once, and she refers to it all the time, that he obviously only thinks that she has a provincial mind. He is provincial and not particularly ashamed of it, but is also interested in learning more. So he's trying to learn about Conrad Swan, about the sculptor, even though he's looking at it and thinking, I can't see how this relates to Apollo. What's going on? It's a very, very funny book. It's also really moving. I think what makes it so good is that main couple, Christina and Dickie, are seeing the worst in each other, but somehow Margaret Kennedy helps you to see the best in them. They're both very sympathetic characters, even whilst they're feuding with each other. And yeah, it's I think it's the funniest novel by her I've read, but also the one with the most heart to it. And yeah, it starts off this quite silly premise, but has a lot of heart to it, and is somehow a bit of a page turner as well. So I think it's by some distance my favourite of the 5 or 6 of hers I've read.
Okay, I've got to look out for that one. Is it in print?
It's in print with Faber Fines, so that sort of print on demand. Nice. Thing. I've been trying to get it into the British Library, but I think because it's technically in print with Faber, then it probably can't be. But maybe they'll elevate it to their main list after the success of The Feast. I don't know, but I think it deserves to be to get a wider audience.
Yes, because The Feast is very good indeed. I'd very much like to read something else by her. Okay, interesting. All right, so number 4 for me, another classic. The Lady's Paradise by Emile Zola,
ah,
which we did indeed read for the podcast.
We did.
Alongside Baba Coombs, which I also very much enjoyed. But I've been wanting to read this book for donkey's years, actually. So I was delighted to finally be pushed to pick it up. And I just absolutely loved I loved the whole story. I loved the main characters and everything. But the thing that I loved the most about it was this glimpse of what it was like to work in a shop and a department store at the dawn of shopping as we know it today in the 19th century, and all of the details of how the shop worked and the day-to-day life of the employees and all of the routines that they did, and how you would buy things, and I just absolutely loved it. And it's one of those 19th century novels. We know they're going to be long. We know they're going to be bloated. We know they're going to have loads of detail. And I just loved being able to immerse myself utterly in that world, to feel like I was walking the streets of Paris, to feel like I was in this department store, and that I would know exactly if I walked in the front door, I could imagine exactly what it looked like. And I would go upstairs and I would go and get my fabric and be measured and all these other things. Just wonderful. So it's also just a really good, crackingly good story. And everything that you want to happen happens. And there's also lots of sad stuff that happens. So you've got that kind of, the pathos, but then also the joy and the will they won't they story at the heart of it. It's just a jolly good read.
It was wonderful, and I'm glad that at least one book we did on the podcast made one of our lists, because none of mine were ones we did for the podcast. Glad you've got a representation of one. My fourth one was out of print when I read it earlier in the year and is now in the British Library Women Writers series, which is wonderful. So Lady Living Alone by Nora Lofts, originally published under the pseudonym Peter Curtis. And so people may well know Nora Lofts as a historical novelist. She described it as a murder mystery. It's not really a murder mystery, but it's, a domestic thriller. It starts off very funny. This is quite an idiosyncratic woman with the wonderful name Penelope Shadow. She's very sort of scatty and inept and a bit of a burden, but she also is very good at writing and somehow writes this bestseller. So she becomes quite wealthy and well-known whilst remaining scatty. And she has this foible that she can't be in a home on her own. She won't be in a building on her own. She can't stand it. She's, even at the beginning, she's wealthy enough to have staff, so, or at least one servant, so it's quite easy for her to not be on her own. And the novel doesn't treat it as particularly serious thing. It's treated more of a sort of comic thing at the beginning, but as the novel progresses, and I don't want to give much away, and I will say, if you pick up the British Library Women Writers one, don't read the blurb. I fought them a bit, being like, please don't give it everything away on the back, but they did. It becomes, darker and more threatening and ends up being really a thriller. She's such a good writer. Her sentences are really funny, but also then really tense. I've not read any of her historical fiction. As we know, that's not my cup of tea, but I think she's so good at this, the domestic thriller. But it's not scary, but it is very tense.
Okay, I like tents. That's fine. So that's exciting. Okay, so one that you yourself have been involved in the publishing of.
Exactly. I was so pleased that I'm quite surprised we managed to get it, but very pleased we did. So, yeah, she's still a bit of a name, but yeah, people have forgotten about these ones.
What's the title again?
Lady Living Alone.
Lady Living Alone. Okay, I like that.
It's a good title, isn't it?
That could potentially be my choice. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So number three for me is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout. Now, I love Elizabeth Strout, as regular listeners will know. I'm always banging on about her. And her latest novel came out this year. I was straight down to the bookshop on the day of publication to get it and read it immediately and absolutely loved it. It's... as many of her books are, they're kind of series, and she has characters from other series come in and out of these books. So people who know her books well, they'll know the characters in here. So it's like Lucy Barton, her husband William, also Bob Burgess, who is a friend of Lucy's, and he's also in his own book called The Burgess Boys. And Olive Kitteridge also features. He's also got her own series, Olive Kitteridge books. So it's just this wonderful meeting of characters, and they're such gentle books, but they're so profound. And much like with Claire Keegan, actually, it's like just brilliant writing that you can't quite put your finger on why it's so good. It just is. And her ability to build a world and to build these characters that you really care about. And there's so much truth in these books. About what it is to be human and experiences that you can connect with. And they're all set in Maine, which is a state I've never been to, but I would love to go to. So I also love reading them because I like imagining myself in Maine. And it's just such, it's so like warm and cozy when you return to this world and these people that you know. But you can also read them as standalone books, which I think is part of their success as well. Like, these are really contained stories that all kind of make sense on their own and are their own, have their own message and their own purpose. But once you can fit them into a wider jigsaw, it's also lovely to kind of be reunited with these characters and see their journey continue. So that was a real highlight of the year for me.
Lovely. Yeah, that was the one book I was confident would be in your top 10. Yeah, for, I think you mentioned it, but also as soon as I saw there was a new book out by her, I was like, that's going to be on Rachel's top 10 this year. My number three, and it's one of those infuriating things where it's impossible to get hold of. So please don't choose this one. But The Spring House by Cynthia Asquith, Lady Cynthia Asquith, who is known in some literary circles as an anthologizer of ghost stories. That was something I think even during her lifetime she was probably best known for. And that's, I think you can probably still get her ghost story anthologies. She wrote two novels, and there's a wonderful Instagrammer called Virginia Old Book Dreaming, who recommended, in fact, her other novel, which I haven't read yet, but I thought I'd start with this one. And it's set in this big mansion and during the Second World War and First World War, I've gone blank, I forget, some war where people are invalided back and they've sort of turned their big house over into a place for invalids. And the heroine's husband is at war. She doesn't seem particularly to be bothered about him not being there. He's actually, I say he's at war, he's a soldier and he's in Canada when the war breaks out. So he's not at the front line, but he is having to be kept there. She has various men that she is seeing, and no one seems particularly judgmental about this. They're just like, sure, your husband's boring, why not? And she's got her relationship with her mother, with and her aunt, and then about halfway through the novel, this other man enters, and rather than all these sorts of flirtations she's had, that becomes much more serious. But again, it's like any of these things, this what makes it special isn't necessarily the plot, it's just the wonderful writing and the wonderful characters. And again, it's one of those books like The Visitors, but much shorter, that I just got completely swept away in, completely loved being in that world. And it's a quite an upper class world. Lady Cynthia Asquith is clearly writing about quite a select world, without really a sense that it is select, it's just the world that she knows. But fascinating creation of these characters. And I think I wrote in my review, they're so vivid that it just feels almost blasphemous that more people don't know who they are. They seem so alive, and more people should know them. And I look forward to reading her only other novel, maybe in 2025. But as I say, it took a long time of me waiting for ABE Books Want Alert to get my hands on this. So it's not going to come up easily. But if you're willing to bide your time, I'd recommend putting up, you know, alerts in all the different places you can get alerts. And if it ever comes on the market, then grab hold of a copy.
So remind us of the title again.
It's called The Spring House. The Spring House in this case is a summer house in the garden, but some sort of childhood joke with her brother. She calls it The Spring House, and that has stuck.
And could it potentially become a British Library classic?
Well, there's a reason why it might not that I'll explain once I've revealed a later title. So that's very vague. But also, I think potentially the other one of hers, but there's a reason why I won't be using that one.
Okay. All right.
Mysterious.
Very mysterious. Right. So we're up to number two. Number two for me is another book I read on holiday, this time in Devon. And it sounds like I'm always on holiday. I mean,
exactly. Do you read anything when you're at home? I guess not.
Not really, no. Too busy reading essays and marking them, unfortunately. Mine is Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner.
Was that your first time reading it?
Yes. So Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner is one of my all-time favourite books, and I've been too scared to read anything else by him for a long time. Because I was like, what if I don't love it? What if it doesn't hold a candle to Crossing to Safety? You know, there's just so much anxiety involved in reading another book by an author that you love. And I was very silly to have left it so long. Absolutely loved every single minute of it. It's set in the 19th century in America and is the story of supposedly the narrator's grandmother. It is actually based on a real story of a real woman that got Wallace Stegner into some legal trouble. It's about a woman who's really intelligent. She is from a good family. She's an artist. She lives on in Boston with her family, and she meets this guy. I can't remember anyone's names. And he is going out west to find his fortune. He's essentially he's an engineer, and he's involved in the mining industry. And after a very long engagement, she, much to the shock and kind of disapproval really of her friends and family, she marries him, and she goes with him out west. And it's a very difficult life, and one that has a lot of setbacks and problems, and the relationship between their marriage suffers as a result. And looking really at what it was like to be a pioneer in the 19th century, like what sacrifices did that cause for a woman. And I think Wallace Stegner is such a sensitive and brilliant writer, and his choice to tell the story of this woman through the lens of a man without it ever seeming like that was a problem, I think is fabulous. And the fact that he wanted to tell this woman's story and to look at what did it cost for a woman specifically to have to do this, you know, who doesn't have any employment, who has to bring up children, who has to make a new home every year or two, who has to put up with the fact that there's no culture, there's no conversation, there are often no other women in these environments as they're traveling to different mining communities. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. It's really long, but I didn't care. And actually, I would have happily read twice as much. I just thought it was absolutely fabulous and like nothing else I've read. And tragically, I spilled a huge glass of water on it. Or did I? Or dropped it in something? Like, I don't know. Yes, my water bottle.
When I assume some swimming pool somewhere.
No, it wasn't actually. I was on holiday, and then... Oh, actually, no, maybe I read this on the plane to Geneva. Anyway, I had my water bottle all over it. But then luckily, the first bookshop I went to replace it had a copy, so I was able to get another one. So it could have been a disaster, but it was all right. But highly recommended. And if you haven't read any Wallace Stegner, then you are in for an absolute treat.
And how would you compare it to Crossing to Safety?
Well, they're completely different books. Okay. I don't think you can compare them. Crossing to Safety is still my favourite, but I love them both.
I did read one after we did Crossing to Safety that I now don't remember about a professor, maybe. Who knows? I remember enjoying it. There we go. So my number two is one that I mentioned. It was one I was reading when we did our Edward Carey episode, is Interpreter of Maladies by Jhumpa Lahiri, that I know you have read. Yes. And this is the one that I wouldn't have read if it weren't for A Century of Books. And I needed a 1999 book. So I listened to the audiobook and was completely bowled away by how beautiful her writing is. I'd not read anything else by her at that point, but I still haven't. I've bought a couple since then. And it's they're mostly about, I guess, relationships. So it starts with one about this couple who, during a lengthy period of power cut, start writing each other notes, and sort of their marriage gradually crumbles. There's, I think, maybe my favorite one about a woman who gets obsessed with Christian statues in a house that they've moved to and keeps finding the, like, you know, icons behind the radiator and that sort of thing, even though she and her husband are Hindus. And this is, again, sort of splintering their relationship. The title story is from a man who makes a living by driving tourists around India, but is also translator at a doctor's, the interpreter of maladies, and he thinks he's got this kindred spirit with the woman he's driving around, but gradually realizes that is not necessarily the case. Most of the characters are either Indian in India or Indian diaspora, and her writing, her sort of searing understanding of people and their dynamics, and just the just beautiful, thought-provoking, immersive stories that have, I think this is only the author I've been most keen now to go and find other things, because I feel like I've discovered a person that I've known about for a long time, first heard of 20 years ago maybe, but had never actually got around to reading, and sort of dismissed as, you know, popular, and therefore maybe I wouldn't like her, but I was wrong, and looking forward to reading more.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I remember really loving it, and I've read a lot of her books actually, and I think they're all brilliant. So you've got a lot to enjoy coming your way.
Excellent. And I'm guessing your number one must be a Claire Keegan.
It is. Can you guess which one?
Ooh, I'm going to guess Small Things Like These.
It is.
There we go.
I was just bowled over by this book, and actually, naughtily, I watched the film first while I was on holiday in Penzance. And then went straight to the bookshop after the next day and bought it from a lovely bookshop in Penzance called, I think it's called the End of the World Bookshop, if anyone's in Cornwall. Very good bookshop to go to. Wonderful collection, lovely booksellers. Highly recommended. Lovely independent bookshop on the high street. And so, you know, again, really short, 120 pages. I don't know how she does it. I'm sucked into this world immediately. It's just the most, I mean, they're not like, it's nothing happens, but everything happens. So it's basically about this man, whose name I've already forgotten. and he is, it's 1980s in Ireland, and it's a small community town. He's always lived there, grown up there. He is the son of a woman who's had him out of wedlock, but she was taken in by her employer, the richest woman in town, looked after. And when his mother dies, I mean, this is all very early on in the narrative, it's not a surprise. She dies very young. He's brought up by this woman, and he goes on to get married, and he's got kids, and that's where we're at now. He's nearly 40. He's got 5 daughters. And he lives in this very traditional community that's very much built around work and the church. But recently he's started to kind of have this feeling that, you know, is there more to my life than this? He sort of had these sort of restless moments where he keeps having insomnia and getting up in the night. And then one morning early on in the book, he his job is he runs a coal yard, and he delivers coal to the convent up on the hill, and they've got a finger in every pie in the town. They run the school where his daughters go, etc. And he finds this girl who's hidden in, who's sleeping in the coal hole, and he takes her back inside, and what he sees inside are basically, it's a Magdalene laundry, and everybody knows that this is there, but nobody does anything about it. And the whole novel is about him wrestling with his conscience, essentially, of, can I live with knowing this and doing nothing about it? And it's just so moving and so powerful and so brilliant. I bought it for everybody for Christmas this year. I've ordered copies for school. I'm going to teach it to my students. I'm really excited. I just think it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And I don't know how somebody can write something so profound in such a small space of words, really. I mean, I've already read it 3 times, and it's first read it like 6 weeks ago. It's just fabulous. I think she's a genius.
And that is the other one by her that I have read. I read it this year, and I thought it was good. And I'm sorry, I don't know what I missed that made it the best
thing. You can read it again.
I do need to. Well, it was a library book, so I returned it on time.
You come and join me with us. And
maybe when I read Antarctica, I will finally get why people love Claire Keegan so much. But my number one is The Spring Begins by Catherine Dunning. And this was a few years ago, Scott at Ferrard Middlebrow, his favourite book of the year. And it was lined up to be, hopefully, in the Ferrard Middlebrow series when Rupert Heath sadly died very suddenly. And so when I messaged Scott a bit later saying, is there any books that you really wanted to appear that now sadly can't, but you think would be good in the British Library series, this is one he sent me. So I've only read it in a PDF that he sent me, that I printed out. And I'm pleased to say that it will be in the British Library series in April. So currently impossible to find, but it's coming out. And that's the reason The Spring House won't, because I think having The Spring Begins and The Spring House in the same series could get confusing. It's just such a wonderful book. It's published in 1934, I think. And there's 3 women who are the main characters who have parallel lives, I guess. They're in the same community, but they don't know each other. And they're all servants of one type or another. So the people who would normally be in the background of a 1930s novel. There is Lottie, who grew up in an orphanage and is now working in the nursery at the rich Kellaway house. She's very sort of optimistic and kind, but also very fearful. She's always been told sort of dark, terrible things about what men might do. There is Maggie, who works in the same household as a scullery maid. She's very sort of flirtatious and knows, she's quite inexperienced, but has, I don't know, she's very sexualized in the way she behaves with everyone, I guess. And then there's the saddest one, called Hessie, who is a governess for the vicar's family. And she is in her mid to late 30s and not married, and her sister is engaged, and she is finding that heartbreaking. So they're all sort of defined by how they relate to men, I guess, or men in general rather than specific men. But have such deep, imaginative, fully realized lives. We see them sort of go about their day to day. Sometimes one will see the other, or, you know, their stories will overlap, but we basically just flip back and forth between them. And Catherine Dunning is just such a marvelous writer. It's beautiful. There's so many, these houses are by the beach. There's beautiful descriptions of sunlight and sea and all these things. It's never sort of overly done, but she really takes you there. And again, there's a few sort of big moments in the novel, but generally it's just about the day-to-day lives of these women who would be, indeed are, overlooked by the people around her. And I think it's so interesting to sort of flip that, the world, so that the people, you know, it's like we're reading To the Lighthouse, but from the servant's point of view, that sort of thing. The people who would normally be in the foreground are there, but in the background, and vice versa. Scott was absolutely right. She's a marvelous, marvelous writer. It's I think it's one of the best books that we've got in the series, and I'm really excited for it to come out. And I'm really excited to have my own copy, because so far I've just got some printouts, and I want a copy in my hand. It was the first book I read this year, And I'm rereading it at the moment, and it's every bit as good as I'd remembered from January, thankfully. But if we're going to do an episode in January, I'm afraid you probably shouldn't choose it. But maybe it's one we could do later in the year.
So it's coming out in March, did you say?
I think April. I'm not entirely sure. Spring sometime. Right. We thought, you know, since it's spring begins, let's put it out for spring.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe before we choose our title from the others list, we can just run through them again. I'm sure there'll be people at home who've been wanting to jot something down and just not caught it. Yes. So I'll just run through my 10 to 1, and then you can do yours. So 10, My Darling Villain, Lynn Rhee Banks. 9, Department of Speculation by Jenny Offal. 8, A Body Made of Glass by Caroline Crampton. 7, The Visitors by Mary McMinnies. 6, Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. 5, The Oracles by Margaret Kennedy. 4, Lady Living Alone by Nora Lofts. 3, The Spring House by Cynthia Asquith. 2, Interpreter of Melodies by Jhumpa Lahiri. And number 1, The Spring Begins by Catherine Dunning.
All of them by women, Simon.
Oh, they are. I didn't even spotted that. But yes, there we go.
Yeah. Very good. Right, my top 10. So number 10 is Maud Martha by Geraldine Brooks. Number 9 is Enter Ghost by Isabella Hamad. Number 8 is 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Number 7 is Foster by Claire Keegan. Number 6 is Chernobyl Prayer by Svetlana Alexievich. Number 5 is Wifedom by Anna Funder. Number 4 is The Lady's Paradise by Emile Zola. Number 3 is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strauss. Number 2 is Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. And number 1 is Claire Keegan again with Small Things Like These.
And I'm intrigued that in your year of reading Orwell did not make the list. Was he close?
He was close, actually. I was umming and ahhing over whether my number 10 would be The Clergyman's Daughter or not, which is interesting because you really hated that, didn't you?
But I thought it was dreadful, yes. Yeah.
I loved it. So yes, if I could have had an equal for 10th place, then The Clergyman's Daughter would have made it.
Interesting. Yeah. Right. Well, I would happily read any of yours except the ones I've read, and maybe except for the Chernobyl one. I'm not sure that drawn to that one. But I'm going to choose for our next episode, and because it's been on my list anyway, I'm going to go with Enter Ghost.
Ah, okay. All right. Okay, I think for your one, I'm going to go with Lady Living Alone by Nora Lofts.
Wonderful. Great. I think there's two books that could hardly have less in common, but as always, we will find something. So in the next episode, Enter Ghost by Isabella, what's her surname?
Hamad.
Hamad, thank you. I've got a squiggle here, so I don't know. By Isabella Hamad and Lady Living Alone by Nora Lofts. It's been a long episode, but hopefully you've enjoyed it. We'd love to know your favourite books of the year. Do let us know your number one reads. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.